Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Podcast, presented by SportsShoes.com. I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
We are back for Season 3 and it's going to be a good one.
With the aim of raising the profile of British distance running, we're bringing you more content than ever.
Every week, we'll give you insights into the lives and training of some of the UK's top athletes and coaches,
as well as all the latest updates from the races up and down the country and around the world.
You can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all major podcast streaming platforms.
Keep a lookout for our new YouTube channel too, where we're posting workout videos, shoe reviews, and much more.
Stay up to date by following us on Twitter and Instagram at Sunday Podcast.
And if you want to drop us a line, send us an email to info@sundaypodcast.com.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Okay, Richard, first off, just welcome to the podcast. Great to have you on. And how are you, first of all?
I'm really well. Yeah. Thanks for having me on. I've listened so many times to this. So what an honor to be with you.
Oh, great stuff. I appreciate that. We thought we'd start with Berlin Marathon, actually, because obviously we want to get into your own career, but we know you're very interested in the sport itself and you've kind of got some involvement too. So what did you think overall of both the men's and the women's races?
Well, yeah, let me start with Kipchoge. I mean, Kipchoge, just amazing, isn't it? I mean, the fact that he just keeps on winning and keeps on going. So I guess, you know, before the race, I was thinking about him and what he was going to do. And he didn't run a world record, but he won his fifth Berlin race and he just keeps on winning. I mean, that guy is phenomenal. He is just, you struggle to find words really, because I do remember him winning in Paris, the 5,000 meters, over 20 years ago, world championships. And, you know, the fact that he's still going, at the top of the game is amazing. And I guess, obviously, you know, I compare him with, highly with Turgat, Kenenisa, Mo and Paula also, you know, for their longevity in the sport. But none of those, and all of those are superstars, but none of those come close, really, to what Kipchoge has done and is continuing to do. So, yes, I was obviously following him, and I'd say I was impressed that he won again. And then obviously women's world record. Well, I guess, you know, when you think of Berlin, you think of world records. So if it wasn't Kipchoge breaking the world record, yeah, it was on the women's side. It was amazing.
And I think we could do a separate podcast on Kipchoge and his career, full stop. But Richard, you're very in the know when it comes to Ethiopian running. What had you heard about Assefa before the race? Was this predicted? Like I said, I was looking at Kipchoge. Maybe we were just, you know, not paying too much attention to the women's marathon scene this time of year. But obviously she ran a lightning quick debut last year. But were people getting excited for a world record from her? Like, was it expected?
Well, I did hear your podcast last week and you hardly previewed the women's race. So I think it must have taken you by surprise, took me by surprise, possibly a little bit less than you did, because I do know Tigist's coach very well, Gemadu Dedefo. I mean, he is probably, you know, one of the top marathon coaches in the world. Not many people know about him. I mean, he's Tamara Tola's coach. He's Amina Barisso's coach, the world champion from Budapest in marathon. He's got an amazing training group. Beliou Amdalak, Mukhtar Idris, so many really, really good runners. And I have spent a lot of time with him over the last few years and have a lot of respect for him. So, it wasn't completely surprising. And I mean, Gemadu himself, I was with him in Valencia last December when Amina Barisa won, which was a surprise because everyone was expecting Letta Sembet to win. And even there, which was 9 months ago, Gemadu was talking about tickets, said, you know, Amina's good. You know, and he was right. She is good. She won the world championship. But he was saying then, but Tigist is even better. And she proved that on Sunday. So, but having said that, of course, you know, to take more than 2 minutes off what was already a very fast world record was pretty amazing.
And she didn't run London because of an injury, that's correct?
Yes, I think I'm right. You know, this was her first marathon since Berlin of a year ago. I mean, the interesting thing was because I was out in Ethiopia in February and May, and particularly in May when the selection hadn't been finalised for Budapest, I was already aware that she wasn't in the squad that was training for Budapest. I mean, it was already a ridiculously strong squad with Yalom Zerf and Sahai and Goitom Gebreselassie and then Amina. She wasn't in that because she'd been injured. So I think everyone knew in the spring that she was injured. And so in a way, you know, over the summer, we were thinking about the World Championships. Meanwhile, you know, she was back in Ethiopia getting ready for this race in Berlin. And she obviously delivered. And again, sorry to come back to Gemadu, but he is such a good coach. You know, the way he arranges training. I mean, obviously, for any athlete to run like Tigges did, you've got to peak at the right time, and she clearly did.
Mm. Yeah, we definitely want to get into kind of some of your own training later on as well. So we'll kind of hold that thought. But obviously, we've got to chat about the shoes too, because a brand new pair of Adidas shoes for the world record. As someone who ran their 208 PB back in the 90s, what's your kind of opinion on super shoes and where the sport has gone in a way?
I think my view is, you know, that the sport of distance running would be in a worse place if there wasn't technology. I mean, just imagine. I mean, particularly there's so much technology in sport as a whole. I'm thinking of other sports. So, you know, it's good that there are advances in shoe technology. Obviously, you know, the shoes that Dave Bedford was wearing 50 years ago were better than the shoes that Paolo Nervi was wearing 100 years ago. And so it goes on. You remember when Coe was breaking world records in the Nike Zoom, they were kind of revolutionary. So I guess what's happened in the last five, six years with the super shoes, yes, the records have fallen even, you know, with even bigger gaps and with more frequency. But so my view is we've got to be positive. We've got to celebrate those advances. But also, yeah, for sure, you know, the shoes also contribute to the fact that people are running faster times, without a doubt.
Mm. Yeah, there are a couple of things as well. I think let's set world record and one of the reasons Kipchoge's, you know, exhibition breaking two race, you know, was not a legit world record is because of the pacing as well. How the fact he had four paces, there was no other people in the race. And obviously, Assefa had a male pacemaker. I was surprised to see all the way literally to about 41 and a half kilometers. Do you agree with that? Should we still class this as a world record? Should there be, you know, the last dropout point in a marathon? Because women, I guess, have an unfair advantage in that.
Yes. I mean, it's slightly easier for women than men, because, as you say, they can have a pacer all the way to the finish. And, you know, without a doubt, if you're going for a fast time, you're running a marathon, if you've got a pacer with you, whether you're winning or not, the chances are that you're going to run a faster time. So we accept that. I think, Matt, when you asked me that question, I don't know why, but I think of Paula's amazing world record. Well, I call it world record. I'm sorry, it was world best, I think, wasn't it? 20 years ago when she ran 2:15:25. And yes, she had male pacemakers. But when I think about that run, and I was in London on that day, I just think that was such an amazing performance by an amazing athlete right at the top of her powers then. And, you know, she trained, got herself in amazing shape for that performance. And it all came together on that one day. And, you know, thinking of her running along the embankment, you know, in the last stages of that race, I think she picked up the pace. She was running incredibly fast miles. What was it, you know, 5:05, 5:08, which was incredibly fast then anyway. And so, you know, the same is true of Assefa. You know, she picked up the pace. Now, yes, she had pacemakers, but she had to do the training. She had to be in the shape that she was. So I don't deny that, you know, pacers contributed to her running so fast. But you know, at the end of the day, you just celebrate the fact that she has run so, so fast. You can see that that's how I view it. And I suppose I also view it as a marathon runner. I mean, anyone who runs a marathon, you know how hard it is to not only to train for a marathon, but to execute a good marathon. So, you know, let's also, you know, recognize that. I mean, sorry, we won't get back to Kipchoge, but, you know, he's the, you know, the role model for, you know, delivering. But it's not easy to get it right. So Tigers did, and we should recognize that.
Yeah, it was a brilliant performance, wasn't it? And I was actually going to bring it back to Kipchoge a bit, because I guess apart from him, from a Kenyan perspective, it seems like Ethiopia has almost got that kind of dominance in the world right now. I think there was a period where Kenya was probably stronger, but it seems like this season, maybe last season, particularly on the women's side, Ethiopia absolutely flying. As someone who's kind of very involved in Ethiopian running, can you talk to us about kind of how that started and then why maybe Ethiopia are doing so well right now?
Yeah, I mean, there's been this great rivalry, hasn't there, between Ethiopia and Kenya over the years. And it is quite funny that at the World Championships, at the Olympics, you know, one of the things that any Ethiopian follower, coach, athlete will be watching very closely is how are they doing compared with Kenya and vice versa. You know, it's funny, you know, while we Brits are following, you know, what's happening, at the top of the medal table, or, you know, how well we're doing compared with last year or 4 years ago, you know, that Kenya-Ethiopia rivalry has been there for decades. So, yeah, I suppose because I live there and I've got so many friends there, I am biased towards Ethiopia. So if you're going to ask me, you know, you can't say straight out that Ethiopia, well, certainly not, they're not always better than Kenya and you know, Faith Kipyegon and so many others. I suppose, you know, one thing that Kenya has that Ethiopia doesn't have is the spread across a few more events. You know, Ethiopia is really 800 metres up to the marathon. I think what's happened is that if we go back 30 years, Duarte was the first Ethiopian female athlete to achieve anything at a global level. And then it took another 10 years, really, before the likes of Meseret Defar and Turunish came through and started winning Olympic titles. I mean, okay, Fatima won the marathon in 96, but, you know, Meseret and Turunish took Duratu as their role model. And now so many of the athletes who are competing in their early 20s are saying that, you know, their role models are Turunish and Meseret. And there are so many more young female athletes around in Ethiopia now. And that's a sort of society thing that families are allowing their young athlete daughters to go out and train. And I don't just mean in Addis, I mean in the countryside, in the highlands of Ethiopia. So that has changed. You know, that's a societal change. What's also happened, of course, is that world road running is, I would say, enjoys a higher profile now than it did 20 years ago. You know, 20 years ago, Ethiopia was achieving a lot of success at world cross country, winning a lot of the team titles. And now I think, you know, athletes like Yalan Zerf, who won London in 22, she is still very young. I think 15 years ago, we would have seen her more doing cross country and track, but, you know, she's gone straight to the marathon. Sahai Gemetu, again, also in her early 20s, has gone, you know, road running, half marathon and the marathon. So I suppose that might explain why, if we're looking at the half marathon and the marathon, we're seeing, you know, Ethiopian females achieving a lot of success, both in the big city marathons and at the global championships. We obviously saw it in Budapest. In Budapest, sorry to say this, but there is another reason in that the Ethiopian Athletics Federation kind of bring their top athletes together to compete in those major global championships in a slightly more disciplined way than sometimes happens in Kenya.
So they're still doing the whole, you know, when you qualify or when they pick their team, they go on a recluse training camp and they're under one coach, even though they may have a different coach that they usually work with, you know, 9 months, 10 months of the year.
You're right, Matt. And you know, let's take the example of Yalom Zerf. Yalom Zerf, you know, she came up, she was third in London, I think, this year, and it was a little bit disappointing. You know, was it going to be her decision and her coach Tessa Matavshiro's decision as to whether she went to Budapest or not? Yes, to a certain extent, but a large part of that decision was going to be what the Federation said. The Federation said, yeah, you've been nominated to be part of the squad. You know, you're going to train with the squad and go to Budapest. So even if the athlete herself and coach Tessema had a different view on that, it was always likely that they were going to take their best athletes to the World Championships, because winning medals at the major championship is a big deal, not only for the Athletics Federation, but also for the country.
And would this potentially explain maybe on the male side, they underperformed a little bit in the 5,000s. You know, we see Kijelcha and Awagawi. Were they adopting different tactics from a different coach, or they were a bit overtrained going into Budapest? Would that maybe explain their performance a little bit as well?
Yeah, I don't have the inside scoop on that. I mean, I do agree with your comment. I think they did underperform because, you know, over the summer we were watching them, you know, win in some, you know, incredibly fast times on the Diamond League. That they go to the championships. I mean, the championships are obviously a very, very different race. And I think you're right that tactically they didn't get it right. You know, to beat Ingebrigtsen, you've got to have a tactic. You can't just think, oh, we're going to out-sprint him on the last lap. That's just not going to happen. It didn't happen. So I think there were one or two reasons. I'm not sure. I don't think they were overtrained or anything, because Kijelcha was in great shape before Budapest, and he was in great shape in Zurich, you know, a week or so after. So what was the reason? I actually think they got the tactics wrong. I mean, when you've got three good Ethiopians in a race against Ingebrigtsen, I mean, but we've seen this time and time again, that the Ethiopians and the Kenyans should run together. I think we saw it once when the Kenyans took on Mo in London in 2017 and in the 10,000 metres, which Mo won, I think. But they gave Mo a really hard run for his money. But so often the Kenyans and the Ethiopians don't run as a team when they should do.
For sure.
But we can't tell them, you know, they'll be winning everything if we told them how to do it. You know, let's have a few Europeans winning some of those distance medals.
It's very true.
Yeah, I think that's it. And obviously there's always that pressure to perform individually, and maybe, I think I always say on the podcast, maybe individually they'd rather a bronze and not risk anything kind of going together. Obviously, we talk about kind of team tactics, but the way Ethiopians train, from my understanding anyway, is that they train as teams a lot as well. So you would think that they might kind of translate that into races.
Yes. They train as, I mean, I think the thing is, Ollie, they train in massive groups. I mean, the Kenyans do as well. You know, team tactics is something is slightly different, isn't it? You know, almost you've got to train for team tactics, which I don't think they do. You know, I don't think the coach sort of says, right, two of you go and, you know, accelerate and one of you stays back, and then, you know, like that. That's what we're talking about in a 5,000 meter race. They just train in very, very large groups. So they're used to having other runners around them who are, I think that's the striking feature of distance running in Kenya and Ethiopia.
Yeah, and I just want to touch on Gedimou before we move on. That coach, you said he's an exceptional coach. He's obviously doing an amazing job to have a woman who's run 2:11:50 odd. What is it about him that makes him such a good coach? Is there, you know, what's his training like, or the best of your knowledge?
I don't think it's revolutionary what they're doing. I think that obviously he's got an incredibly, you know, talented pool of athletes, and you know, those training groups, they, you know, say, you know, if you turn up to the track or you turn up to a dirt road where they're doing a 30k run, you know, there'll be 40 50 60 athletes, and it'll break them up into groups of 15 20, and you know, I think any one session is not something that would really shock you. You know, I've seen them do 12 times a K, or, you know, a 30K progression run. So it's not anything that any other European or Western athlete can't do. But I think it's, well, sorry, Matt, you're asking me specifically about Gemadu. I mean, I suppose, yeah, he's learned a lot, I suppose, over the years. I mean, that there were probably a few more, slightly more experienced coaches in Ethiopia, like Haji Ajilo, who was actually working with Gemadu for the World Championships. Tessema Abshiro, who is slightly younger than Gemadu, you know, he's come up. He's one of Global's top coaches, and he worked under Gitani Tessema. And I guess just over the last 20 years, they've kind of worked out what works. I mean, it's partly just a lifestyle. It really is a lifestyle. It's I think the athletes that listen to their bodies and the coaches are not obsessed by mileage or anything like that. You know, if the athletes need a day off, they have a day off. You know, there are plenty of those easy days, but there are plenty of pretty hard days. You know, the 35K, 40K. Long runs, and then those hard sessions on the track, and then you've got that environment, high altitude. I mean, those track sessions, they often take place at Kenenisa's track up at Sulalta. I mean, it's 2,700 meters. I mean, I know Mo's trained there. I know Gary Locke takes his group up there. So it's not that Western athletes don't train there, but if you try doing, you know, kilometer reps at 2,700 meters, it's pretty tough, you know. So but yes, I refer to the fact that also you've got to peak at the right time, and I think, you know, Gemadu has learned the art of that, and you know, we've seen it because he's brought those athletes like Tamrat Tola, like Amina Barisa, to the big championships at the right time. I mean, it was quite funny being in Valencia last December when Tamrat Tola came as the world champion and was expecting to run incredibly fast in Valencia. And of course, I think he was in very, very, very good shape. But then Kiptum kind of surprised everyone in Valencia. But fortunately for Gemadu, he had Amina on the women's side, so he could still go home happy.
Yeah, Rich, we just wanted to chat about kind of how your kind of stuff with Ethiopia, I guess, started. Like, when was your first trip there, and how did the Great Ethiopian Run start? What's your role with that too?
Yeah, I mean, I was there from the beginning. My first trip to Ethiopia was a month or a couple of months before the Sydney Olympics. I was trying to make the Sydney Olympic team, which would have been my third Olympics, but I had quite a few injuries in my last year or so of running, so I didn't make the team. So I'd already, in the summer of 2000, with Gail, my wife, we decided we were going to move on, and we had gone out to Ethiopia just for a week to check out whether Addis would be a place where we'd enjoy living and working. And then we went out to live there in 2001, and lived there for 9.5 years. And I suppose that's why did we go to Ethiopia? It's partly because my wife's a medical doctor who specializes in global health. And also because I'd spent a lot of time in Kenya as an athlete and felt very much at home in Kenya. And so it didn't feel that far removed from Kenya, certainly first appearances of Ethiopia, although the more you get to know Ethiopia, it is quite a different country to Kenya. So we ended up living there and really enjoyed our time there. And I suppose that was the time when I really got to know Haile, worked very closely with him, and feel very privileged to have got to know him. And we set up the Great Ethiopian Run. That was not just a race; it became an event management company, and I've stayed closely involved in that in the 13 years since moving back here. So. Yes, and I suppose my work has been, over the last 20 years, has been in event management. I mean, I was race director of the 10K while we were living there. And Since then, I've been involved in different projects, I suppose, in Ethiopia, largely in tourism. And then for the last 3 years, working with Haile in his coffee business.
I can't imagine, you know, being on that good terms with Haile Gebrselassie, obviously a fine runner yourself. But any favourite memories of Haile, favourite race of him?
Well, Matt, I do remember when he was, you know, when he was competing on the track. I mean, I was still running in the 1990s and watching some of his incredible races on the track. I do remember quite clearly, I think it was 95 when he smashed the 5,000 meter record, took over 10 seconds off the record. And, you know, I was still competing then. And that was kind of one of those moments when you thought, gosh, Haile is just out of this world. He's just completely ahead of his time to take 10 seconds off a 5,000 meter world record. I suppose my favorite memory, you know, personally, was in Berlin in 2007 when he broke the world record for the first time. And, you know, at that point, we'd been living in Ethiopia for 6 years. I'd got to know Haile very well. I often went out on a mountain bike with Haile when he was doing his 30, 35K tempo runs. I think the significant thing about, you know, Berlin in 2007 was that it was Haile's seventh marathon. And every marathon Haile did from 2002, his first international marathon in London, it was for Haile, it was an attempt on the world record. He wanted to break the world record. And of course, you know, he thought he could do that in 2002. And on his seventh attempt in Berlin, finally, he ran 2:04:26. And I was just so, so pleased for him because actually earlier in the year in London, he dropped out of London and London was never a good venue for him, strangely. You know, he'd won in other places, hadn't broke the world record, but then went to Berlin. And I was just so pleased for him to win in Berlin. And then I was there again a year later when he was the first athlete to go under 2 hours and 4 minutes. So, yeah, they were special memories. And I think they were also, you know, pretty special moments for Haile in, you know, he had an amazing 25-year international career. So he's got so many of those special moments.
Well, this is it. And now we can move on to the coffee company Haile, which you've partnered with Gebrselassie on. How's it working? When's it released? When can we get our hands on it? And is he just as calm in business as he is or was on the track?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me personally, the launch of Haile Coffee is in some ways it's sort of the culmination of knowing Haile for 30 years or more. I mean, I first met Haile in Zurich at the Weltklasse in 93. Were you guys born then?
No, 96 okay. We are.
Well, you answered it correctly. I mean, it's a long time ago. And then obviously in the 1990s, I can't say I competed with Haile, but I was at the same races as Haile. But then, as I've explained, got to know him very well. Great Ethiopian Run was the thing that we, you know, really brought us together. And but equally, even in the years that we were living in Ethiopia, you know, Haile built his first hotel. He's now got over 10 hotels. And when he built his first hotel, I was quite closely involved. I regularly went with Haile down to Wassa in southern Ethiopia. So I think the point I'm making is that, you know, we've done a lot of stuff together. And then it was because of COVID that I wasn't able to continue the tourism work I was doing. And Haile's daughter, who's in her mid-20s, needed some help with Haile's coffee business that Haile had delegated to his daughter, because Haile's business empire is so big that Haile wasn't really and no still isn't closely involved in his coffee business. He you know, set up a coffee farm 10 years ago and started to employ people to produce coffee and then to sell coffee. But Haile's got so many different business interests as well as all the other things he does for his country. So, but I think over the last 3 years, while I've been working in trying to sell Haile's coffee on international markets, so many people have said to me, wouldn't it be great to bring out a product that, you know, people who are his fans and his followers around the world can enjoy. Because up until, well now, I've been selling green coffee, which is just the raw beans. So I've been selling to big international importers. Now, if you go to our website, highly.coffee, you can order a pack of Highly coffee, roasted coffee, 250-gram pack. And that coffee comes directly from Highly's farm in Western Ethiopia. So, you know, I feel it's a privilege to be able to say this, that, you know, I've been associated and worked with Highly, who is an amazing athlete, but he's also an amazing person. He's an amazing businessman. And for me personally, in a very small way, it sort of brings together all that I feel fortunate to have been involved in with Highly over the last so many years.
What a story, man. I mean, it's smart packaging. The coffee looks smart. And I think you're dead right. You're going to be selling to his fans. I think there's a lot of runners out there who will predict that Highly coffee, does it give them an extra boost?
Yeah, well, I ought to mention Joel and Spencer. You know, I'm not doing this on my own here in Brighton in the running community. Joel's he coaches our daughter, and he's a very good businessman. And both Joel and Spencer are very well connected in the running community. So I think all three of us are coming at this wanting to, I mean, take it to our friends and those people we know in the running world. So there's a lot of roasted coffee out there. But we'd like to think that we're kind of serving our home community, in other words, our runners. And so, yeah, for sure, Matt, we're going to be talking about the benefits of caffeine for performance. It's been well documented in scientific studies. That's certainly one of the angles. But I also hope that people will really just enjoy the coffee. It's really premium coffee. You know, Highly was a champion. One of our products is called Champion's Choice. It really is a very nice coffee. So thanks for giving me the opportunity just to plug that. So if you are a connoisseur of coffee, I hope you'll also appreciate the coffee for its quality as well as, you know, where it's coming from.
I'm sure we have a lot of those listening, mate.
Yeah, and Rich, we got to chat about your own running because, as you mentioned already, two-time Olympian, 92 and 96. I learned something today. I didn't realize there used to be 10,000-meter heats back in 96.
Yes.
Because I was doing my research and I found that you made the final, and I thought, why are we qualifying in a 10,000? So that must have been quite a grueling process in Barcelona. But let's just chat about how you kind of got into running in the first place. How did your journey start?
Oh, gosh. Well, we have to go back a long, long way. You've probably now heard of Bradford Grammar School because of Emil. Of course, I used to say because of Alistair and Johnny Brownlee. But we were all old boys of Bradford Grammar School. So the point about that is that I started running at school because of two incredibly dedicated school teachers who were in charge of the cross country club. So started running as an 8-year-old and did all my running as a teenager at school, joined Bingley Harriers when I left school. Obviously, you know, went on to uni, never thought at that point that I would become an Olympian. And I suppose I was lucky that when I was doing a lot of running through school and university, and then I finished university in the UK, went out to the States for 2 years on a scholarship. And it was really my 2 years in Boston that just gave me a few more years to pursue my running. I guess, you know, probably if there are a lot of students listening, and they probably can identify with that you get to the end of your first degree, and you know, there's a fair bit of pressure, expectation on you to get a job, as there was for me from my father. But I had those 2 years in the States, and it was then in Boston where my running really took off. And by the time I finished in Boston, I'd run for Britain in the World Cross Country in 89. And so I was a bit of a late developer in terms of my first senior international, but then I had, you know, 10 best part of 10 years competing cross country track and road, and had some great years. And I suppose, you know, when I was competing through the 90s, my focus was always the major championships. Britain's track and field team was going through a pretty good period then. Think of the Linford and Sally and Jonathan, Steve Badgley, Denise, you know, Colin. It was great to be on the team with them. And my first major championship was the European Championship 1990. And my last one was the European Championship 8 years later, funnily enough, in Budapest in 98. So in those years, I ran 10,000 metres and the marathon, but always focused on the championships rather than the big road races.
You wish you targeted a big road race at all?
I did, Matt. I targeted London. I'm pleased that I was in good shape when I did run London. I only ran London once, which is quite funny, in 97. And, you know, 96 and 97 were my best years. So I didn't run my perfect race in London, but come on, I've got to be pleased that, I got to the start line and I was in good shape and I ran, my best time I ran in London. But I think I don't have any regrets, really. I just feel very fortunate to have been able to do what I did with the support that I had from Bruce, my coach, and Sue and training partners, and going off to train. It was a bit of a different era to a certain extent, the sport hasn't changed hugely.
You still went on to run, you ran 208 in London that year, and me and Ollie were fascinated when we were reading up about your training reports saying you boasted 152 mile week in the lead up to that. People aren't doing that now, or at least I think people are starting to go back towards that crazy high mileage. But what was the thinking behind that? Do you think Brits or, you know, Europeans have shied away from that hard work over the last 20 years?
Well done for doing your homework. I mean, I think I did go up to 150 miles twice, I think. 150 miles in a week twice in my career. It wasn't a regular thing. I suppose I just took the view that I wanted to get the best out of myself. And, you know, I suppose it's funny, when I was a 14-year-old at Bradford Grammar School, I was running 60 miles a week. You know, to do high mileage was just normal for me. That wasn't the problem, if you like. I just loved running. So, you know, by the time I became an international in my mid-20s, you know, running 100, 110 miles a week was the norm, and there were plenty of other very good British runners who were doing that as well. I think what changed when I went up to the marathon, particularly I talked about 96, 97, I switched to a pattern of doing two hard weeks, one easy week. So that's, you know, where I got in the 135, 145 in the two hard weeks, and then came down for an easy week. And I think I did that for three marathons. It worked really well for me in Atlanta at 96. It worked well for me in London in 97. And then I overcooked it later the same year at the World Championships in Athens and never got to the start line. So it is a fine line between really training hard, pushing yourself to the limit and not overdoing it. And I went a bit too far, but, you know, hey, that's sport. You know, I think the reason I ran so well in Atlanta and London was that I was able to, you know, get up to those high volumes. That was one of the factors among many.
What's an easy week when the hard week's 140?
About 95. Yeah, I mean, but again, it's, you know, it's in a 12-week period, and Ollie, I think you touched on that early in the conversation. You know, the art of peaking. I really, you know, I still believe in it, and I believed in it then. You know, it was particularly when you're running the marathon, it's about, you know, being in top shape one day in the year. You know, the Olympic marathon in 96 was on the 4th of August, I remember, and that was the day that mattered. And so, you know, after Gothenburg the previous summer, that was the race I wanted to be in shape for. So you have to get your timing right, which means that at other times of the year you're not in, if you like, either peak shape or in top training. You might be training for other things, half marathon or cross country, but then I would move into marathon training with a pretty specific 12-week build-up, which is when I did my hardest training.
And I'm right in thinking you would get that course profile as early as possible, get that locked in and try and replicate that as well.
Yeah. Wow, Matt, you've done your homework. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yes. I went out to San Sebastian before the World Cup marathon 2 months before. I went out to Atlanta, 3 months before, on the way to Boulder, where I was going to do my training to look at the course then. I remember, I think Dave Moorcroft, who used to commentate on some of my races, he used to call me meticulous. It's just about, ticking all the boxes, really. Meticulous. It's basically, you try your hardest. And I suppose, particularly a course like Atlanta, which was not a big city. So the Olympics, it wasn't a big city race. So it was important to get to know the course. And as I said to you, five out of my eight marathons were championship marathons. So it's pretty important to know the course more than, say, if I was running loads of Dubai and Berlin marathons, which are, pretty easy to understand what type of course it is.
Well, me and Ollie always talk about this because in triathlon, they have just a few weeks ago, they had their kind of pre-Olympic rehearsal, if you like, hosting a triathlon out of Paris, and they don't have that in marathon. They don't have that on the road races. And, I don't think, as far as I know, many people sort of do look at the courses in that much detail as you used to do.
No, well, it's interesting you refer to Paris because, of course, I'm not going to be competing in Paris, but I did pick up that that was a joke, by the way. And the Paris Olympic marathon course is pretty tough, isn't it? So I think that the people, the top contenders need to take a close look at it. I'm sure they will be. I don't need to be telling them that. But I suppose there are a few more variables that come into play in a championship marathon. One is the nature of the course, and of course the other thing is the weather, which is regular feature. And it was in Budapest this year, and it probably will be in Paris. It may not be quite as hot as Budapest, but that's why championship marathons are so often very different from races like we saw in Berlin on Sunday, last Sunday.
Yeah, I think it seems absurd, doesn't it, that you kind of hear of a lot of elite athletes who back their shape in a way over prepping specifically for the course. Of course, we know we need physiological fitness, but I think doing things like it sounds like you did should be the bare minimum in a way.
Yeah, I think, British athletics over the years, the last 20 years and more have got very good at that, having holding camps and being very serious about, helping their athletes to prepare, very specifically for that one race. I think, that's where possibly British and Western athletes sometimes have advantages over Kenyan and Ethiopian athletes, where sometimes they don't go to that detail. They just, I suppose, rely on the fact that the athletes are strong, they've been training hard, and there's a good group of them, and that sort of group will carry them through. But often, the acclimatization and knowledge of the course is important. It's certainly not the most important thing, but just one of those things that it's good to know about.
Mm. Yeah, well, of course, we saw it with Kipchoge in Boston last year, didn't we? So, but anyway, we'll let you crack on, Rich. But thanks so much for chatting to us. It's been great to hear about your insights into Ethiopia, but also your own career, of course.
Thanks.